Hi, my name is Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Wolf Wrench.
And this is Edge Cases, a podcast about mostly Apple-related software development and 70s BBC documentaries.
Aha, you've done your research.
This is episode 14. We're recording on Sunday, August 18th, 2012. And today's topic is maintenance and the Cocoa Swad.
Oh, okay.
And are you familiar with that terminology?
The Cocoa Slide?
Yes.
I have never heard that terminology, so I guess this week I'm the ignorant sap.
All right, there we go.
Okay, so for our listener, so we can keep our listeners in loop, I've already apologized to Andrew for calling him an ignorant sap on the air. I usually like to do that off the air.
Yeah, right. Perhaps by Twitter, for example. Yes. And I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. So off we go. So I have one piece of feedback here. One of our listeners sent us a long email about AppCode, attempting to convince me to use it, even after I had a whole episode about why I wasn't going to use it. And my reaction to this is pretty much a phrase that I've just learned about called GYOB, which is get your own blog, which is not actually entirely the right way to use that phrase, but never mind. When you send an email to us, the only audience who is going to read it is me. Well, okay, Wolf's going to read it too. And Wolf is more open-minded than I am. We all know that. But for me, my mind was already made up, as evidenced by the entire episode. So the email is kind of wasted. So the way to get around that, my advice to everyone who's sending us feedback, is if you have a long-form piece of text like that, you really want to write your own blog post and then email us the link to it. And that way, we will mention the blog post on air and put the link in the show notes. And that way, even though my mind is all made up, you get a chance to convince all of our listeners who have so erroneously been convinced by my arguments that, well, I was all wrong and they should listen to you instead. Make sense?
Pretty much, yeah.
So this is not my idea. John Siracusa first mentioned this a while back, but I am agreeing with this idea. I am propagating it.
I was kind of thinking that I don't think we've so far have gone back and added a link to any of the show notes, but it's pretty easy to do. So I can imagine if you got a blog posting that's relevant to a previous show, we could just tack that on to an existing show notes.
Well, we could tack that on, or we could tack it on to this show. If you're listening, if you're an ongoing listener, then it shouldn't be that difficult to say, oh, yeah, they mentioned this, so now I'll go. Especially if that was interesting to you.
Yeah, that would be at least a little gift we can give our long-suffering listeners.
Yes. Our poor, decrepit listeners. Okay, so moving on. So for this week's topic, it started when I went to the Cocoahead San Francisco meeting this month. Now, I mentioned that meeting last month, I believe, or perhaps the month before that, because I was going to give a presentation about edge cases there, okay. a little short presentation. Now, it turns out, for those of you who missed it, I didn't actually give the presentation because there were technical problems. But the person who did give the presentation that night was someone named Andy Arvanitis. And I did check the pronunciation of his name with him, so I hope I got it right. He is the creator of the Aero language, E-E-R-O. And the language, I kind of knew something about it, but it was good to get sort of more detail. And he has slides available for this presentation. I will put that in the show notes. The Aero language is entirely syntactic sugar, as opposed to only being a little bit of it or this and that. So it does not provide any advances in programming language capabilities the way, say, Haskell does. So Andy justifies using it by saying it's all about the maintenance cycle. Now, the maintenance cycle is a 1977 Harley-Davidson, but that's not important right now. What Andy says in his slides is a bunch of things that I agree with. He says that code is read much more than it's written. He says even reading your own code after a few months or years is like reading someone else's code in terms of how well you're going to understand it. He says that human parsability, as opposed to parsability by code, by program, is critical for your code, mm-hmm. and readability matters a lot. So all things I completely agree with. His solution to these issues is a new language, and that language will then be less cluttered than Objective-C and easier to read and understand. However, I think this runs into practical constraints. the chance that the person who's going to work on the code after you will know Arrow is pretty small. Mm-hmm. So if the point of maintenance is to make it easier for that person to deal with the code, well, you're not making it easier. And this can be a problem both with large projects and with small projects. So if you're at a large company that's just hiring general Cocoa engineers who haven't learned this language, okay, that's one problem. You might think, well, I'm doing my own project, that I'm a sole developer of this application. I'm the only one who's ever going to work on it. So isn't that going to be fine? Well, maybe and maybe not. So if you get acqui-hired, as we've been talking about, right?
You just want an excuse to say that word again.
maybe. Then you'll be working at this other company. They'll be, you know, paying you money to do that. And you will want to get rid of your current applications because you don't have time to work on them anymore. You have to sell them to other programmers. And those programmers might not know Arrow. Hmm. Or they might not want to deal with Arrow, with learning it. So you may not be able to make the money you want off of that application. So there's problems there. And if you're not starting a new project, if you're working on an existing project, which is, of course, what maintenance engineers do, you will have to mix Objective-C and Arrow code in the same project, which seems like a bad idea to me as well. So Arrow has a bunch of good ideas. It's a good experiment, and I certainly wish Andy luck with it. But I think that since maintenance is all about the long term, it's not necessarily the time to experiment. And so I wouldn't recommend Arrow as the way to solve a lot of these maintenance issues or to make the maintenance issues go better for you. So my take is going to be a little different. So I'd like to apologize to Andy. I said I was going to mention Arrow on the podcast. I didn't say how I was going to mention it. So sorry there.
Promise nothing.
And, you know, again, it has some good ideas. So it's a decent thing to investigate. And I also think that Clang has already taken some of the same innovations, not necessarily getting them from Arrow, but some of the same innovations and ideas into its own code base. So for instance, the array and dictionary syntax, uh-huh, which is much less cluttered than doing it with regular method calls. And so I think they're also going to do more of that in the future, which bodes well for Objective-C. It means that we can get a lot of those same decluttering advantages while still having sort of everyone learn them at the same time because they're all learning them as part of Apple's tools. So my take is going to be a little different. Now, when I'm reading existing code to add features or to fix a bug, I don't want to scrutinize every word of the code like it's some kind of holy text. I want to skim it to find the parts that I actually want to change or to add to quickly. So if I were using my finger to keep track of where I was reading on a, let's say, a giant 30-inch screen,
I would be sliding. You have a greasy 30-inch screen, don't you?
Well, I don't have a 30-inch screen at all. This is a hypothetical 30-inch screen. I would be sliding my finger down the screen at an even, rapid pace. Hence, Cocoa Sled.
Oh.
Now, of course, the name is, in addition to being a bit ridiculous, also misleading. It's not just for Cocoa. It's for any programming language.
So you're saying you basically had to invent something so that way this could spring on me.
yeah, I kind of did.
Low blow, man.
I admit nothing. And so everything I do as part of writing code is to prevent slowdowns or hitches in that slot. My code has to be understandable when I browse it or when other people browse it. So does that make sense so far?
Yes.
Okay, so let me give you some examples. So for example, one of my rules is that code should not have a large amount of comments in it or long comments. You shouldn't have a paragraph's worth of a comment in the middle of your code. Hmm. Because reading a paragraph's worth of text is not browsing. It's not sliding, and it slows you down. In fact, I would say that comments should be pretty rare in your code. They should be the exception rather than the rule. So am I saying that you shouldn't make your code understandable? I am not. Code instead should be self-documenting. So there's, let's see, about four things I want to talk about in terms of self-documenting code. These are all kind of rules that I've put in place for myself. So in self-documenting code, all the names in the code should summarize what they do. So that's class names, method names, IVAR names, local variable names, the whole shebang. So for Objective-C method names, you already have a bit of a head start because the parameters are labeled. So for example, the NSString method, write to file, colon, atomically, colon, encoding, colon, error, colon. If you were to write that same method in C++, you'd probably just call it write to file. And so if you were looking at a call site of that method, now most of the parameters in there you would probably be able to figure out from context. For example, the string name is the name of the file or the path to the file. The encoding constant, something like, you know, NSUTF-8 string encoding, well, you'd figure out what that was too. And you'd probably figure out what the error parameter is because the error variable would probably have the word error in it. That's easy. But then the last parameter in there, the atomic flag, is just a yes-no variable. It's a Boolean. And so I've seen, I actually saw this a ton of times in C++ where it would just have a true in there somewhere. And we're like, oh, well, what does that mean? Well, that's going to interrupt your SWOD because you have to go and look at the method declaration to see what it means. Whereas in Objective-C, because you can label your Booleans, you don't have to do that.
So my question for you, are you a KCF default allocator guy or are you a null guy?
That's a good question. Well, one, I don't actually use that API very often. And two, what I would tend to say is it's going to be usage dependent. Okay. For the most part, I would probably be a null guy just because it's less verbiage to go around.
Okay.
But that would require that the people who are reading the code, both myself and other people, would know that convention.
I'm kind of a constant guy in that case, even though like the CF Core Foundation API is like so standardized with having the allocator being the first parameter in all the functions. Still, I put in that name constant because I feel that when my head is outside of CF and I come back to it, it's like much more obvious to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one thing that I probably won't get to later, but I do want to mention that it does depend. These are my rules, but they are very dependent on who you're working with. And if the point is that other people and yourself can do the SWOD, I feel like there should be a song involved, right? Can do the SWOD. If you're writing code that you can understand, but they can't, well, then there's going to be a problem. And of course, that's going to lead to some issues. You need to make sure you find the right compromises so that everyone can maintain code as well as they can. And so I've often seen that in myself when I'm first starting to use a particular method and it has some tricky stuff in it, I may put in some comments there for myself the next time I look at it because I'm still not used to that method. But if I've used it for a couple of years and I'm working with people who have all used it for a couple of years, then I wouldn't put that comment in there. So it is dependent on the people involved.
Sure.
That, so if, you know, if I were working with you on a project and you said, no, you know, we want to do this all the time, well, you know, I could live with that. And the thing that I did with C++ is, and this is from a book, I think, and I should have looked it up beforehand, but I didn't. I will put it in the show notes if I find it. Maybe it's like C++ usability, using C++ or something. So it's fairly famous, where he said, instead of using true-false, use an enum. Instead, for instance, if I was using write to file, I would have a write atomically or write non-atomically or something similar.
Right.
And then when in every call site, I would be able to know what that meant very easily. That's the way to get around that in C++. So that helps to have those things in your method call site. But it's also important that the method names be accurate. So if I have a method named plucked chickens, for example, what gets returned by that method damn well better be an array of chickens without feathers. If it's not, then you should rename it. But it's also important that the methods be readable, and readability actually trumps technical accuracy. So you stick with what's important in the method name over too much verbosity. For example, in your chicken app, you might have free-range chickens versus coop chickens, large versus small, dead versus living, but you don't want to have a method named plucked free-range large dead chickens because that will, again, that will interrupt the slide, that will make it harder for you to figure out what's going on, because you have to parse that every time you read it. And you might notice that in the middle of that method, there's actually some redundancy. For example, if you are plucking a live chicken, you probably have more problems than what to name your methods. So you could probably take the dead out of there at the very least, but mm-hmm. but you just make it easier. And that's the reason to do that. If you see methods which don't encode all of that information, that's why you want to do that. Now, I spend quite a bit of time names, not necessarily chicken names, but names. If I can't think of a good name for something, that's a code smell to me. That tells me that I should probably look into rearranging the code or reorganizing things in some way to make the whole thing more understandable. Okay, so that's method names. For IVARs, I would say that the names, the most important thing when sliding through the code is to distinguish between IVARs and locals. And Objective-C, again, makes this easier with its conventions, because IVARs normally have an underscore in front of them. That makes it a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And also with newer Objective-C, you can use properties. And for me, then, having an underscore in front of the name, underscore foo versus self.foo, same thing, because they give me exactly the same information that I need when I'm maintaining the code. Properties are probably a little better because I, for example, don't use underscores with outlets. And this is just a convention of mine. It looks worse in Interface Builder, now Xcode, to have things hooked up which have underscores in them. And it seems like that's not necessarily the custom in source code, in sample code from Apple. And with properties, you get your cake and eat it too. You can have things that, when you use them, tell you immediately that they're IVARs while still keeping losing the underscore for outlets.
Yeah, I find myself going, I find myself going back and forth between using the underscores directly and or doing self.foo. Fortunately, I think it was pretty much with the fact that synthesized by default has pretty much standardized the underscore foo naming convention. It was already kind of, you know, it was definitely the common case, and it was kind of backed up by KVO. I'm sorry, KVC. And so it's definitely a common convention, but still it was kind of like not fully like this is the way you should do things. And I've seen a lot of code that also doesn't use the underscore foo kind of naming convention, but I've totally gone over to that side now. And now I basically view the underscore as a warning, as like, you know, I'm using it in my init methods and my dealloc methods. And of course, you know, Arc reduces the need for custom dealloc methods for there. So, you know, I view the Arc IVAR access as I'm accessing something kind of lower level versus the self.foo route. And it's kind of sad because, like, I know in my heart of efficiency hearts that when I access the self.foo, I am going through KVC. And that's a slower call to make than accessing the IVAR directly.
Yes. Yes. If that's something that, yeah. So mostly you don't have to worry about that because you don't want to optimize prematurely.
Sure. And yeah, that's what I keep telling myself.
Yeah, it's when you cry yourself to sleep at night.
That's right. Over efficiency patterns. Yeah.
Right. But it's a good point. With the old version of synthesize in Xcode 4.3, right? It would synthesize foo to the underlying instance variable foo. Mm-hmm. I saw in a lot of the code that I have maintained over the years is that because you could use self.foo and foo interchangeably, right, people wouldn't use it consistently. Mm-hmm. That would mean that, now you might say, well, that's not that big of a deal if the accessor mutators are not doing extra things. And I'm here to tell you that with the Goatless slide, that is taking away information that I want. Hmm. I want always to be self.foo because I don't want to have to look up whether foo is a local variable or an instance variable. And by making the new, when you remove the synthesize statement, use an underscore foo, that makes things easier on me because then people won't make that mistake. And the only way that they'll have IVARs is using the correct naming scheme. That makes things easier for me.
I also want to mention that the hopefully you don't get too off topic here, but the sample code is that you get from Apple and use it as a guide is, as you probably know, a very double-edged sword. It's you know, you can kind of get the gist alt of what you should do, what the patterns are, by reading the code. However, there's a lot of bad sample code out there.
There is, yeah. You should take that with a grain of salt. Another thing that I would say, and this is definitely getting, well, not necessarily off topic, but I'm mentioning it a little early. But the other thing to keep in mind when looking at Apple code is that a lot of the code that you're going to look at, not sample code, but the framework code, is code written for extreme reuse. And this comes into play with the delegate pattern. Mm-hmm. And I've written a blog post called Delegate. You remember that blog post?
Well, I do.
Where I talk about how if you're writing your app code, which is very specialized, excuse me, where there's no reuse, where it's just one time something calling something else, very tight coupling, using the delegate pattern in that case seems to me to be overbuilding. And we're going to talk about overbuilding in a bit, but I'll just mention it now. And I got some pushback on that. People said, no, you should make sure things are loosely coupled because that's the way you do things. Mm-hmm. Read the blog post to see more details. I don't want to talk about it in too much depth. And my response to that is, again, that pattern is for reusable code. And when you're not using reusable code, when you're just using your own code that needs to be maintained for years and years the way it exactly is now, without adding any more extra features, without adding any new clients, go for the easy stuff instead of going for something which adds more complexity.
Yeah.
Again, help with the slide. Mm-hmm. So moving on.
I think we should, you know, you said Cocoa Slide is too specific. I would call it the Pontius slide.
Well, then it's just my slide. Then it's not anyone else's slide.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, we have laws, you know, it's named after the inventor, but isn't just for that inventor. So I think that's a false dichotomy. I think it could be the Pontius slide.
The slide for the rest of this presentation. Maybe we'll see what feedback we get.
Okay.
And there is that half the people will then mispronounce Pontius, but maybe that's the price of fame. Yes. So another thing is, the second point about self-documenting code is not to get too unnecessarily tricky with the syntax. And the example I have here, which is kind of silly, but I think you'll think of your own examples of people who've done things like this, is if you're iterating through numbers, so odd integer numbers, so 1, 3, 5, 7. So the right way to do this is to say in your for statement, I equals I plus 2, so that you know that the I is incrementing for 2 each time. Mm-hmm. And someone who's trying to be clever might say, well, the first half of my for loop is using the I as an even number, and the second half is using it as an odd number. So what I'm going to do is only do I plus plus in the for statement, and then use the I as an even number, and then do I plus plus in the middle, mm-hmm. and I as an even number in the second half of the statement. And that means that I don't have to fiddle around with calculating what I really is or doing all that extra stuff. Now, that may seem like a good idea to you at the time. What it does is, in my maintenance of this code, when I'm skimming this code, what am I going to think when I look at that for statement? I'm going to think this is a loop that just goes through the numbers one by one. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be disabused of that notion when I read through the rest of the method, assuming the rest of the loop. And even then, when I find out that it's being tricky, I'm going to stop that slide right away because I'm going to have to look through that loop with a fine-tooth comb to see if there's any other trickery that I'm not catching. It's just going to make things a lot more difficult. Now, a lot is relative, right? It's not going to take 2 hours, but it is going to slow me down at a point where I'm trying to find what I actually want to find, and it's just going to be bad news.
And I would also argue that the skim is inherently lossy. I mean, when you're looking through chunks of code and you're skimming along, you might not notice that there's that extra I plus plus nestled in there. And so you've just looked upon this for loop and you say, oh yeah, this is going through one by one, when really it's going by, is doing something tricky. And if this happens to be the chunk of data you miss, now you have an incorrect understanding.
Right. And again, it's probably not going to make you make a really horrible mistake over the long term. Mm-hmm. But it's going to. And glossy is a good way to put it. I think one way that I thought of this when I was thinking of this topic is also like listening to a podcast at a higher speed, or listening to a podcast the way you you fast forward in the iPod Shuffle, possibly on other iPods as well, where it doesn't actually speed it up. It just gives you little snippets as you go. It cuts out certain pieces of it. And you can figure out what's going on, certainly. It all still works. But yeah, it is glossy. So it's best when the podcast is not very dense.
Which is what we strive for.
This is what we strive for here, yes. Talking very slowly. Now, if there is an unavoidable gotcha, that's when you add a comment. That's that special case that we're talking about. So if you have a method that you need to use and you know is problematic, for example, because you haven't had a chance to rewrite it yet, or it's from a library that you know you need to use, then you're going to want to tell me as the maintainer of your code. And I realize that as I'm going, I'm switching from saying, here are these generic rules, to complaining about the people who write the code before me. But that's how it goes. So then I want to know those things as succinctly as possible. Again, don't put a paragraph. Just put exactly what I need to know when I'm sliding down that code. And you also want to future-proof this comment. So what I do is I date it, and I put my name on it as well. Hmm. Strictly necessary, because you should be able to figure it out from the SEM commit, who put it in and when. But SEM commits take time. Again, you're screwing up the slide. And they also might have been obscured by further commits. So it's really, again, you just want as much dense information right there as possible so you can figure out what to do there.
Yeah, and so also like the blame or the praise or the annotate mechanisms, they're all the same thing. Those unfortunately aren't too well integrated to the editors we are using. So it tends to be like another command invocation. So you have to be really interested in that comment, typically, in order for you to shell out and do a git blame or what have you.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, Xcode does it pretty well.
I mean, doesn't the editor, when you're doing your slide, I don't see Xcode telling me that that line has been authored by someone unless I invoke a mode.
True. That's true. So yes. Yeah. Again, right. You really want to, if you want to have it right there, which I do, then put a little comment there. And this also makes it, I think of it as a distinction between the things which are exceptional cases, things which are wrong in the ideal way of doing things, versus just say, here's how this works. So I tend to date and time things, add date and my name to things where I was like, you know, it's kind of the apologies is what I think of it. Sorry, we had to do it like this, as opposed to, well, here's how this method works. This is sort of documentation versus apologies.
That's interesting, because I'll have like, well, in development, I'll write a method the way I think it should be written, and then I'll later on hit a problem, what have you. And I tend to do like a pound if one, and then I put the code that has to really do it, and then I pound else, and then I explain why this code looks like it should work, but you really can't use it. I explain then in a small, maybe one or two line comment, why this code that looks perfectly fine you should not use.
Well, now in your editor, well, I suppose you're using Xcode some of the time, but do you have other editors where the else block there is in a commented out color?
No, that is a problem if I use the preprocessor like that. But I don't know. I find the preprocessor like a little bit easier to deal with in terms of that. But yeah, I miss the syntax highlighting.
Well, you want the, so in one way that gives you the syntax highlighting for the code, which is
right
out. So that's good, right? So that's what you were saying. And in the other way, yeah, you might miss it if you're skimming really, really quickly. So it might help there if that's only something you do for short amounts of code rather than short of code, for example.
Yeah.
I tend to suggest that for larger amounts of code, which you know you're not using at all, as opposed to having it be there for demonstration purposes, it's a really good idea to take that stuff out.
Yeah.
Again, it fits with all the rest of the rationale that I'm going through here. You don't want it there because you don't want to skim through it and say, well, what's this method do? I've done that a whole bunch of times and it sucks. Mm-hmm. So
I'll throw in a little tip here that sometimes you'll find that you code up something and it works really well, but then your design changes and you don't need it anymore. It's perfectly functional code that you just don't need at that point. When I delete code, I put that in its own separate commit where I'm just doing a pure delete of that functionality. And then in the commit message, I spell out don't need with no apostrophe there. So don't need, all uppercase. And then a little comment of what this code used to do. So that way it feels safer to me. Like I'll be able to find those commits. And in fact, I have when the design changes yet again, or some other project needs them. Like I had that code. Oh yeah, I deleted it in this other project. So it makes it a little bit easier to stand out amongst the thousands of commits to go back in time and cherry pick that code out and reanimate it.
Right. And so you're basically giving it a label, even if you're not accessing the label feature of your SDM system.
Right.
I mean, in some ways, you're sliding through your commits.
Hey.
There you go. The wrench slud.
Let's not assign our names to it then. Okay.
Slud. No, that doesn't work either. Okay. So that's actually, I'm going to skip a couple things. I said there were four things, but we're going to try to make up some time here. There are only two. But so I talked about self-documenting at the code level, but self-documentation is also a good idea at the higher level as well. So I'm sliding through individual code blocks, for example, or individual methods, but I also want to slide through the files, the code files, the headers, the .m files in my project as well to be able to find just the right place to do the work I need to do. So a lot of the same techniques work there as well. You want to make sure the names are self-explanatory and short. You want to, the relationships are, again, the same thing, self-documenting, short. But further than that, I want to get back to this idea of not overbuilding. So I talked a little bit about sort of not using a delegate pattern when you don't need it. I suspect people might argue with me about, but we'll see. I would also go so far as to say that even if you, so let's say you're working on phase A, and you know phase B is coming up. And so phase A has certain features that you're implementing, and phase B has more that you know will be built on top of phase A, you may be tempted to start adding in some things you know you need for phase B as part of phase A. So for some people, they think of that in terms of being, you know, being prudent, making sure you don't miss things that need to be added later, make sure you don't engineer things the wrong way. But I am here to tell you that's wrong. Well, all right, that's wrong in my opinion anyway. Because, well, there's a number of things, the number of ways that that's going to go bad. That code that you're writing that's only going to be used for phase B and not phase A is code that you can't test. And you may potentially then write a lot of code before you realize you're on the wrong track. So that's bad. Also, the requirements might change between now and when you actually start phase B. As we talked about, you're going to be maintaining this code for a lot longer than you're going to be writing the first version of it. And that will probably be true between A and B as well. So you may find yourself working around all this extra code for months or years before you start using it. And I think it's also true that existing code warps new code. If you know you need to add things for B and you start writing that now, everything you do for the rest of phase A is going to be, have to again deal with that fact, and it's going to be written around that fact. And as you said, the assumptions you make might be wrong, so you may just get sort of all twisted in the wrong direction as part of doing this. So, but what that means is that, okay, so I just write phase A as if I'm only writing phase B. I forget phase B completely. Well, that means that when I do get to phase B, I might have to change a lot of things. To which I say, yes, that's the way you maintain code. And the best way to make that easier is to make sure that the code you wrote during phase A is as simple as possible. Because then that means that you can change it in whichever way you need to in the easiest way, because you don't have to hack through a lot of extra stuff that was never needed when you started off. And so that will be true in whatever direction you go. If phase B is canceled, if phase B is moved up, if phase B is split out into B1 and B2, whatever, you're in the best position to do that. So actually, that's pretty much it. So tried to go through it quickly enough to get ourselves down to a decent time for this episode. So does that make sense?
It does. So I shouldn't bring up some prior points then. We should probably get this cut off here then.
No, yeah. Why don't you do your bit, and then we'll end things off.
Okay, this should be actually pretty short. So first of all, I'm glad you pronounced the Arrow language. The name of that pronunciation. I've been calling it Eero, like Earrow, Eero. So I'm glad that it's apparently just pronounced Arrow.
Is Arrow how it's spelled? I mean, Arrow is how it's pronounced.
And also, so I actually tweeted a link to Arrow it feels like a few months ago, maybe even a year ago, but it was definitely a while back. And the feedback that I got from the peoples on Twitters is that they were disturbed by the lack of punctuation.
Yeah.
So it all Arrow tends to read a lot like Ruby in that, you know, lowercase letters on everything. And I'm sure, you know, obviously if you're compatible with Objective-C or has some camel case in the names there and all that, and I guess also in the method names, but it's definitely big on, you know, throwing away all the little spiky points of the square braces and the curly braces and so forth, and kind of making it read more like prose, I guess.
More like a scripting language, certainly.
Yeah. And then the it actually never occurred to me that people would actually like that syntax, which is weird because, like, as a kind of a lispy guy myself, that I really like the kind of explicitness of Lisp. So I can totally see that side of the argument there. Is this I tend to think like Objective-C. I mean, kind of the Arrow language points out that, I mean, if you can build language where you throw away this extra syntax and it works, then, you know, then it seems like you're just, you know, adding information that doesn't actually give you any better understanding versus Lisp, where it is structural. So there are arguments back and forth there. But the other thing I wanted to mention is that, so you said that I didn't know that Arrow was strict, like sugary syntaxy layer on top of Objective-C. I thought it added stuff. So if that's the case, then you were talking about how it's the other developers might not know Arrow, and that would be a risk to the project. It sounds to me then that if it's a strict syntax sugar superset, then a mechanized translation to Objective-C would be quite feasible.
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
So you could in theory do that. I don't think one exists right now, so, you know, you'd have to take time out of your maintenance schedule to actually write that. But you couldn't use. So he actually uses a version of the Clang compiler to compile this down to the binary, mm-hmm. which is what binary compatible with regular Objective-C. The trouble is you can't use that compiler, you can't use the front end of that compiler to get Objective-C out of it. Because he mentioned something about it pulling in too many headers as part of the pre-compilation step. So there are technical issues with that, and rolling your own might not be the easiest thing in the world. So again, it might not be practical, but yes, that's a good point that if someone did manage to write that, and I think they probably could, given a little bit of time, then that would mitigate the factors with that. Of course, you'd have to make sure that continues to be updated so that it continues to work with your code as your code gets written, et cetera, et cetera. But it is one aspect of that I hadn't considered.
Okay. Okay, that does it for me.
All right. So please visit our website, edgecasesshow.com, all one word, to look at the show notes, which we mentioned a couple of times during this episode. Also to see a link to our podcast on iTunes to give us feedback, which we do welcome, even if it'd be better if you wrote your own blog post overall, then you send it to us by email. You can also find us individually on Twitter, myself, A. Pontius, APONTIOUS, and Wolf, his last name, Wrench, the word rent, RENT, plus Z, plus SCH. So we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.